after that. So I don't know if you guys remember, but I'll just remind you at this point. I think I wrote it down. When your finals are, you guys are December 15th, right? Does that make sense for everyone?
Yes.
From 1 to 3. That's terrible. Well, anyway, it is awful, really. I mean, 1 to 3, but I have no choice about that. So, also, the other class has an exam at the other section is December 13th. I don't mind if you have to switch, but just let me know beforehand. Don't just come to one or the other. I'm assuming you will all be at the December 15th one, unless you have permission. And that's just because I actually do hand out two different tests. I mean, they're pretty similar, but I need to make sure I have the right number and everything. But just clear it with me if you need to do it beforehand. Or if neither of those dates work because of sports or whatever, just let me know, and we can talk about that. And I'm sure it won't be a problem at all. Yes,
Emma. Is this going to be the same format as the other tests?
No, it'll be, it's a lot different. So it's kind of like a weaponized version of midterm 1 and 2. not to sound too nasty about it, but it's got three parts. So one, the main part will be an essay. And I can, the essay question is, it's what is, or something like either what is or define Western heritage. Mm-hmm. And it's huge, right? And so there are going to be a lot of different ways you have to go about that. And then I'll give you what you guys normally have as your midterm. You'll have the definitions. And then there are anywhere from 10 to 20 short answer questions, like when did the barbarians sack Rome kind of things. So, the main test is definitely the essay should be worth, if I remember right, 40%. Each of the IDs are worth 10%, the definitions. And then, no, that can't be right. I'll let you know later. Okay. But, yeah, so it'll be fairly even, yes. But it will take the full 2 hours.
Okay.
So, and by school rules, and I agree with this, so I always say by school rules, but not as any way of disagreeing. We also, the test has to be comprehensive. I'm not allowed to give you a final that's not comprehensive. So, okay. Veronica, do you have the same question? Or?
Yeah, that's pretty much the same question. For the essay, will it be like a, will you want the same format as the essays that we've turned in, like three body paragraphs?
Well, you'll have to, since I'm telling you now the question is essentially defining the Western heritage, you have 3 weeks to get ready for it. But it's not one of those things, I'm not going to grade you on grammar like I would on an essay. It's just I'm grading you on argument and how you put that argument together. So think about that. Don't be overwhelmed by the question because it's actually, it's both the hardest and the easiest question I could ask because you can each approach it. You know, if you want to say, let's look at the Socratic ethic as a way of understanding the Western tradition, fine. If you want to do it, here's ancient, medieval, and modern, fine. So there are a lot of different ways you can go about answering that. I just want you to start. So the kind of time you put into it, preparing for it, is pretty demanding. But when you get into the classroom, I'm not going to grade on spelling or anything like that, right? So, but I can tell, you know, having done this for 18 years, I can tell pretty quickly if, you know, you, and none of you, as far as I can tell, have done this on your exams. I can tell pretty quickly if you're just thinking off the cuff versus if you've kind of planned it out. So that's pretty obvious. Yeah, but that I haven't found that with you guys, and especially with your class. So, I mean, you guys have been outstanding, absolutely outstanding. So I'm not worried about it. But don't walk into it without having prepped a lot. So, Scott.
Yeah, for the short answer questions, are some of those going to be, or at least what kind of questions are going to be on the study guide? Or should we start reading crazy now?
No, don't. I wouldn't even study for them at all. They're those kinds of things that I've just said in class, and you either remember them or you don't. I study, you will know on the study guide, you have the essay and you have the IDs. That's what you need to study. And that's because that's the only thing you have pure control over, and that you do have absolute control over that, how you study for that. The other things really are, I would call them trivia. Yet they're not. So, for example, I may give you, how would I do this? Some of them will be multiple choice. Some will be fill in the blank. And then I might have a quote or two that says identify the author in the context, something like that. So, but I don't, I mean, from my perspective, these aren't obscure questions. There's stuff, like I said, repeatedly, like, you need to know the invasion of the barbarians, right, of Rome, right? When did they invade? Stuff like that. It may not all be quite that easy, but, you know, I would expect you all to know when the Great Schism was, when the fall of Constantinople was, those kinds of things that, you know, we've talked about when I put dates and stuff on the board. So we can get into this later if you want, but my whole theory behind this, and I could be wrong, but my theory is that when you're learning... Sorry, one of my kids stuck an empty fruit wrapper. Assorted fruit Mott's medleys. Nice. Okay, artificially flavored. So not even... Yeah, we'll throw that one away. I did not eat those. So my theory is this. When I'm testing you in a humanities course, you should be able to answer a huge question. You should be able to define terms. And you should be able to at least know some basics about names and dates. So, but I would never focus a whole test on names and dates because I hated that when I was a student, and I also don't think it's good teaching personally. So I hope that, so big, narrow, tiny is kind of the perspective. So yeah, Mary Kate.
Will we have a list of terms pretty close to what we've had before? Will we have like 60 terms or
no, something? You'll have about 30. They will be over, so they'll be from all three parts of the class. So it'll be, but it'll be things, nothing's going to be too shocking. It'll be Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, the virtues. So there won't be, if there is anything shocking, it would be more from the section we're just doing now, just because we haven't had as much time. That would be the only reason you'd be surprised. Luther probably will be on it. But I'll get you all that, I promise. I mean, in fact, I could probably get that for you this week. So, it's not a problem. I pretty much know where we're going. Okay, good. Yeah, Emma?
Oh, that was my question, just like how quickly can you get that list to us?
That's a very good question. And tell you what, I will do my best to have it to you by Wednesday. Okay. Does that sound fair?
Thank you.
Yeah. No, it's great. It helps me too. I mean, one more thing to get done. Mm-hmm. So, that's great. Okay, good. John?
Sorry, how many IDs?
Oh, same. Probably four. But I'm not positive yet.
Okay.
But I think that's right, because it would be one essay, four IDs, and then 20 points worth of the trivia stuff. Yeah, I think that's right. So basically, the trivia stuff's worth one ID, right? No, worth two IDs. Yeah. But let me think about that. I'm not good. Unfortunately, thinking of math right off the top of my head, that's a terrible thing to admit, but it is true. I don't think I suffer from innumeracy, like some people suffer from illiteracy, but probably is close. So, okay, good. That's not what I really wanted to talk about today, but I'm glad it's actually very good to kind of get that out because it gives us more time as we're finishing up the course as well. Today, we are going to focus, and appropriate, I think, after Thanksgiving, we're going to focus on what the Reformation is and what's the significance of the Reformation. I want you to realize, and I'm sure most of you probably already know this, but we are 499 years away from the Reformation. Next year is the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. That's a big deal to think that it was 500 years ago, next year, that Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses on the door at Wittenberg Cathedral. And I also actually remembered to bring some colored chalk in. We'll do a little timeline here. But I also would like to note that I am actually, despite the fact I'm a practicing Roman Catholic, I actually find Luther and Calvin quite fascinating. And I think both of them were heroic in their own way, in large part because the church was corrupt at that point. And in fact, it was severely corrupt at that point, not everywhere, but in lots of places. So I say this because probably if my Catholicism revealed its bias, it was more when we were talking about things like the Incarnation. But I don't think I'm quite as biased, or at least maybe I've deluded myself as we're talking about Luther and Calvin. So I'll do my best to be as fair as possible about them. But I'll even tell you guys, this is probably really silly, but my wife was Lutheran when we married. And we had a Lutheran wedding. I didn't really think much about it, even though I was Catholic. We had to get permission from the local bishop. But I will tell you this. I don't usually talk about it. But I'm funny now that I'm getting older. It's funnier to think about in hindsight. But when I asked my wife to marry me, I nailed, because she was Lutheran, I didn't nail, I used tape, actually, but I taped 95 Reasons Why She Should Marry Me on the cathedral door in Helena, Montana, and took her there at 11:20 at night. So on February 12th, it was a very cold Montana night. I had a friend on the lookout in case the priest came by and tore it down. I have a strange love of Luther in a lot of ways. But, okay, so I want us to think about where things go in terms of the church. So if you guys remember, as we were thinking about the church itself, so early church, I'm going to skip, but we go to 1054, and it's in 1054 that we have what's called the Great Schism. And that Great Schism is the break of East and West. So really the difference between a Latin church, Western church, and a Greek Orthodox church. So one will become what we call the Roman Catholic Church. The other will become the Eastern Orthodox Church. They had been always in tension from the very beginning, but they had also agreed to get along. And so in 1054, after years of various struggles, and some of the struggles, at least to me, I hope this doesn't offend anyone, seem a little bit trivial, but they were things like, should a priest wear a beard or not? Those are minor things. There were major questions as well. Questions about what do we do with icons and iconography? Who is actually the head of the church, the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, or the Patriarch of Constantinople? So you get a lot of division, but mostly the scholars got along. So this is not atypical, and we'll see this in the Reformation as well. So the ecclesiastics, the priests, fought, but generally the scholars kept talking to one another, and that's so important. I would call this the kind of humanism of the West that keeps things together and prevents balkanization. But that Great Schism, for a lot of reasons, happens. So I do want to make this point, because I think for a lot of you, especially if you're Protestant, you have to kind of put yourself back in a different position, and that is the kinds of things that Protestants will say about Catholics during the Reformation, especially that Catholics worship Mary and that they worship the saints and they have an undue reverence for these things. Those were exactly the same complaints the Roman Catholic Church had about the Eastern Orthodox in 1054, especially with the idea of iconography. So the fear in the West, which I personally don't think was a legitimate fear, but it was a fear nonetheless historically, was that the Eastern Orthodox were worshiping their images rather than revering them. Exact same argument you'll hear Protestants make about Catholics in the 1500s. So this division here, and there are other divisions as well, and some, you know, again, even though I'm Catholic, I think the Orthodox were probably right about one of the major divisions between the two, and this one I'll write down, is that the Western Church, especially with Aquinas and others, tended to focus very, very strongly on the issue of reason and what can reason do. The Eastern Church was very content to leave many things a mystery. So it's almost inevitable, because of the search for reason, that the West would have to define what communion is, using the term transubstantiation. That is, that we have to define how much of it is Jesus, how much of it is still the bread, and so forth. Whereas the Eastern Church basically says, my gosh, it's a gift. It's a thing of beauty. Why would you ever try and break it down with your petty human reason to understand that? And there's always a much stronger mysticism in the East than there is in the West. And I think that's a really important point to make as the difference. They both love mystery. They both admire reason. But the emphasis on one or the other is very different depending on where you're at. So we'll divide here 1054 into the Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church, or the Latin Church. That remains the same up until, and I realize that if you're Protestant, you will celebrate Reformation Day, the 500th anniversary, next year. I don't actually think that's the proper date. So you can agree or disagree with me. But we do know that on October 31st, of 1517, Luther nails his 95 reasons for leaving the Catholic Church on the cathedral door in Wittenberg, but he's not actually leaving. It's more that it's an internal disagreement that Luther is hoping to have debated. Luther is not out of the Catholic Church until January of 1521, and that is by mutual consent. Luther wanting to be out of the church and the church wanting Luther out of it. But it does take that long for Luther to be out of the church. So I understand why we would date the Reformation to the posting of the 95 Theses, but it really isn't until January of 1521 that we have that. Okay, so here, and if you guys remember all the way back to when we started talking about Christianity, now we end up having three branches of Christianity. So we have the Eastern Church, which will divide, but not theologically, will only divide nationally. So you'll have a Romanian church, you'll have a Russian church, and so forth, but theology remains quite consistent across Orthodoxy overall. Then you have the Roman Catholic Church, and you know, it's one thing that I can't stress enough, Protestants and Roman Catholics share 1,500 years of history. So you know, no matter what, you can't, as a Catholic or as a Protestant, it's pretty hard to forget that. So they share that much history. But then we have this third branch, which we call Protestantism. That is not a name that Catholics gave to them because it makes it sound like they're protesting. That term actually came from a division within Protestants themselves, having a debate basically between Luther and Calvin and the protest. So it sounds, Protestant sounds easy if we want to just think, oh, well, that's anti-Catholic, or they're trying to say they're not Catholic. It's not quite where the term comes from by any means. So it's an internal debate among those in the West who are no longer Catholic. So now I get to use my colored chalk for a bit. In the Reformation, and again, I want to stress a couple of things here, and one that I find critical for all of us, because in 2016, this is easily confused. So we'll make this Protestantism. I'm just going to put it here for convenience sake. So this is now Protestant rather than up there. Protestantism divides into three parts. So out of the Protestant branch, we'll see three major divisions. The first division is one that we would probably just, and I say this without prejudice, this is just how historians put it. This is what's called the conservative Reformation. And this will be two people in particular, those who follow Luther and those who follow Calvin. That's the conservative Reformation, or yeah, if you're a Lutheran or a Calvinist, you would probably call the proper Reformation. But they're the first. And Luther is without question the first to really break from the church, though it's mutual. He's not just walking away. The church is getting rid of him as well. The second group is what we would call the radical Reformation. And the radical Reformation is mostly defined by the people who will be known today, though not quite yet, but they will be known as Baptists. And especially Anabaptists. Now, I have to explain what all that is. I don't know if we'll get to it now. Well, yeah, I'll come back to it in a moment. And then the final branch, denomination or group within Protestantism would be the Church of England. And that's the weird one. And I'll try and explain why that's the strange one out of all of these. John?
I think it would be more accurate to show this. Do you show it coming off of the Roman Catholicism? Because it did.
Which one?
The Church of England.
I'll get to that, okay. Promise. So that's a major part of this. So, all right, so these are the three ways. And the reason I break it up this way, and to go back to John's question as well, is, well, okay, so two things I want you to know right now as we're thinking about this. Number one, there is no evangelicalism in the way we think of it today. That does not exist in the Reformation. Now, the Lutherans called themselves evangelical, But that's not what I mean. When I say evangelical, I mean the kind of once saved, always saved, I met my Lord Jesus Christ last Friday at 6 and now I'm saved. That's that kind of evangelicalism that posits this kind of Jesus' best friend, Jesus' brother, Jesus' buddy, Jesus holds my hand as we walk to heaven. That kind of evangelicalism, which I don't care if you're Catholic or Protestant or Orthodox, we have all been influenced by this idea. Every one of us, it's everywhere in our modern culture. That does not come out of the Protestant Reformation. It is Protestant, but that will be a second Reformation that occurs in America and Britain in the 1700s when evangelicalism, modern evangelicalism, arises. Right. So that point number one. So when we're talking about Protestants, please, even though Luther will say things like priesthood of all believers, there is hierarchy everywhere in the Reformation. And the idea that we'd think of Jesus as best friend would have been blasphemous to the Reformers. Absolutely blasphemous. So that what we think of that kind of casual best friend, that's all about 300 years old. It is not 500 years old. And I don't think Calvin or Luther would have recognized that kind of religion in any way, shape, or form. It's just not a part of this. Is that clear for everybody? And for those of you, when you take American Heritage, we do several weeks, actually, just on this point. All of us do, all of us teaching American Heritage. But I want you to know that for now. The second thing that I want you to understand about this, and this is, I think, going back to John's question as well. If we were to take a map and look at it, let's say if we had a map let's go make it easy, 1650. So once the Wars of the Reformation are done, if we were to take a map of Europe and we were to show exactly this is Catholic, this is Anglican, this is Lutheran, this is Calvinist, you would generally, now there are exceptions here or there, but you would generally find that everybody is happy with the choice that has been made. So those countries that remain Catholic, totally fine with remaining Catholic. Those countries that became Lutheran, very happy to be Lutheran. Those that were Calvinist, very happy to become Calvinist. So in general, where the Reformation happens, the people are behind that move. Now, here's where that gets really complicated. There is only one place in all of the old world that changes without the consent of the people, and that's England. And that's what makes the Church of England so weird, because the English Church was the only place where you had absolute brutalization of the citizenry, killing all the old Catholics to allow for the Church of England to flourish. That's why when John asked that, I was very glad he asked that. But at the same time, this is a critical part of understanding the Reformation. The Anglican Church, what we call the Episcopalian Church today, is the only one that was formed out of force on its people. So they're the only place that would be, and yet the English, after the Reformation, are totally happy. But in large part, that's because all those who opposed it were dead. That didn't happen in a lot of places. It was truly kind of genocide against the Catholic Church there. Okay, so everybody okay with that, or at least understand. So here's the other problem that complicates it. So those are the two main things I want you to know, but here's another problem. And that is, even though the Catholic Church is deeply, deeply corrupt, possibly the most corrupt it's ever been, at the time of Luther, and the church always goes through stages. At times it's really corrupt, then it gets itself, it reforms itself, and then it gets corrupt again. And this is a cycle of church history. It's just the way, for better or worse, well, I guess for worse, but I suppose it's normal too, the way things work. But you also have to understand that there were places within Western Christendom that were totally fine. So the two least corrupt places in terms of the church, the places where the church was working perfectly, basically, for all intents and purposes, ironically, were England, where it was flourishing like it had never flourished before on the eve of the Reformation there. And strangely enough, and I know this goes against a lot of our mythology of the Middle Ages, Spain. Spain had almost no corruption in the church. Now, that's also the home of the Inquisition, but it had really little corruption at all. The church, they weren't taking money. They were using church offices the way they should have been. There were good priests and good nuns. Same place in England. So they were probably the two least corrupt places in all of Europe as we start this process and the movement towards Reformation. Okay, so any questions so far? Or John, do you want to follow up on what you'd asked earlier? Okay, anybody else? Okay, so let me give you this. So as we're getting into these divisions, I want to give you three things that have to happen for the Reformation to occur. So, and I'm not, please know, I'm not discounting individual will. I'm a huge fan of free will. And there's no doubt Luther made his choice, Calvin made his choice. I don't mean to claim by giving you these that somehow this was inevitable that would happen. But there are three things that I think are essential to understand for the Reformation to happen when it did. Number one, without question, outside of England and Spain, there was corruption everywhere in the Catholic Church. This was the church at about its lowest point when it came to corruption. And nobody in the history of the church has ever been as corrupt as the Pope, right before Luther, Alexander VI, the one who Machiavelli is praising. He is, if someone would have told me, you know, obviously I'm being a little extreme here, but if someone said, you know, Brad, Alexander VI was the Antichrist, I probably wouldn't fight too much against that argument. He was that bad. So he was utterly corrupt. And yes, there's no doubt the church was doing things which were completely against its own teaching. They were selling indulgences. They were selling tickets into heaven. I mean, it was crazy. And you had a lot of people profiting. They would have been, and again, because I'll have to forgive me, this, I'm showing my age, but these kinds of priests who were doing this kind of thing would have been the kind of big-haired, you guys notice I got my hair reduced, that had been 7 months' growth. That was I probably dropped 10 pounds after that haircut. But anyway, these were, and you'll see why I brought that up. These were the big-haired preachers of the 1980s who appeared on television all the time. That's, I think, some of the most corrupt, despicable people today like Joel Osteen and others. I mean, just prey on the ignorant and the old and try and steal money from them. That's what these guys were like in the Catholic Church at the time of the Reformation. Not everybody, of course. There were very, very good people in the Catholic Church. You had great people like Erasmus and Thomas More and John Fisher, amazing people, Bellarmine, Suarez. But you also have really terrible people as well. And a lot of them tend to be in the hierarchy. So that's critical to understand. The second thing, which I think is equally important, is that we have to recognize this is the first time in world history we see the rise of what we call nation states. The medieval's over, right? There is no more medieval. It's gone. So, and that means there's no Christendom. And that Christendom has really been gone for 200 years, at least 150 years, by the time we reached the Reformation. It had a slow, long, painful death. But during that time period, with the breakup of Christendom, we see the rise of modern nation states. And one of the most convenient things any new nation can do is to try and find some kind of glue to hold its people together. And there has never been a stronger glue prior to the development of ideologies than religion. Religion is one of those ways you can rally. Oh, you're Austrian? Well, then that must mean you're hardcore Catholic. Oh, you're Prussian? Well, then you must be hardcore Lutheran. And it's unfortunate that what we find is that nation states learn very quickly that they can use the church, and this is no knock against any one form of Christianity, but they can use the church as a way to hold their people together and rally them around a national ideal. So that becomes critical to the rise of the nation state. So what we think of as modern nations, whether we're talking about modern Germany or the United States, all of this begins right before the formation of the Reformation. So the first, if we wanted to define nation state, probably the first would have been sometime in the late 1400s, prior to the rise of Protestantism. But there's no doubt that the division between Protestants and Catholics and between Protestants and Protestants fueled nationalism. So nationalism came first, but it may have died had it not had various religions to compete with one another. Does that make sense for everyone? I think this is a crucial point in understanding Western civilization. So the nation state arises before the Reformation, but the Reformation fuels it. So I'll just give you here. I don't think we need to go into quotes. I think it's pretty clear when we look at it. And I would ask you, make sure you read your textbook on why we see the rise of nationalism. Kagan does a very good job. All right, the final thing that matters here in terms of the three great things, and then I'm actually going to give you a fourth, but the final thing that matters in terms of things leading up to the Reformation is, and I think this is just going to be as obvious as possible, the Reformation demanded a printing press. You couldn't have had a Reformation based on reading scripture without a printing press. Because you guys remember, we went through the painstaking detail of what it took to create a Bible before the printing press. Once you have movable type created in the 1450s, you now can start publishing generally. And you don't just have to publish religious tracts or the Bible. You can actually start writing commentaries on the Bible. You can start writing all kinds of things. And this is where, you know, forget Luther, the Lutheran for a moment. One thing that we often forget about Martin Luther is he was an absolute entrepreneurial genius. He was more involved in the printing trade than any other person of his day and age. We can actually say, I mean, all modern German, of course, comes from Luther's translation of the Bible into German. That's Hochdeutsch. That's where it comes from. But aside from that, so Luther's critical just for history from a linguistic standpoint. He is also critical because nobody understood what the printing press could do more than Luther. Luther was the Steve Jobs of his day. He was an absolute genius when it came to printing, publishing, and getting that distributed. He really was Steve Jobs. If you can imagine Steve Jobs, who actually believed in something besides worshiping his Brussels sprouts or whatever. Luther was that. And you know, almost during his lifetime, we can say, and I'm just giving you a rough figure here, but it's not far off the mark. Luther was probably during his lifetime responsible for roughly 80% of all publications the world over. So that's how powerful he was as a printer. He understood this new technology could change everything. And he understood it very, very wisely. So I stress this, and please, this may sound like I'm kind of defending Catholicism here, but I'll just say this as objectively as possible. There is a reason when you walk into an Orthodox or Catholic church, it's just full of images everywhere. There's a reason there are statues everywhere, icons, stained glass. There's a reason that you have all kinds of incense burning during those. The entire idea prior to the development of the written word being distributed to a population is that you tell the story through the senses. So yeah, there's nothing, stained glass is, it's not telling any different story than the Bible is. There's no, it's the same thing. It's just kind of like a graphic novel that you get to look at. And once you get the written word though, now what happens? I can easily form a church. In fact, this room is a perfect example of what a Protestant church could look like. There's no stained glass. We don't need it. You can have clear glass. There's no reason, in fact, for Calvinists, the wall here would be decadent. We'd want it pure white. The idea that it would be this, what is it, kind of, it's really not that attractive, is it, now that I look at it? Kind of an egg. No, it's not egg. Is it kind of a tan linen color? Right, maybe whatever, yeah. Even that would be decadent for a good Calvinist. And what would you find at the center of, say, a good New England church? Whereas in a Catholic church, you're going to have an altar, and you're going to have the tabernacle, and the priest is going to be there in his vast garments and so forth, all colors representing the liturgy and the seasons of the liturgy. Well, a Protestant minister can just stand up there in the middle, no longer needs the altar, because now the word doesn't mean the body of Christ, it means the word of God. That's a huge change in the Reformation, that we would take the meaning of word from it being Christ to it being the Bible. Right? At least that's a major change. And why not? He can be in plain clothes. We're not celebrating the liturgy. I mean, I hope you guys realize, if you were good Calvinists, Grand Rapids, they didn't celebrate Christmas until the 1930s. If you were a Calvinist Presbyterian, you could not celebrate Christmas. Christmas is no different from any other day because there's no liturgy. So Christmas was a crazy Catholic thing. That's what those pagans did, right? I mean, that's a huge thing. That's a huge change in American society. So I don't have a tabernacle. What do I have? I've got my pulpit, I've got the Bible, and I preach. That becomes the center of the church in more hardcore, I won't say fundamentalist, but hardcore forms of Protestantism. So that's a major change. So the printing press not only allows for literacy, it also allows a religion that doesn't have to rely on image any longer. So just historically, and I'm not trying to knock the argument, I've heard many times, you know, good Protestant friends will come into a Catholic church and the incense bothers them. You know, why would you, you know, light this stuff during a service? You're just distracting yourself from the word of Christ. Why do you have all these images? It just means I'm not focusing on the gospel. And I understand where that's coming from. But of course, historically, there's absolutely a good reason why Catholicism and Orthodoxy arose with the image as opposed to the word. It's just fundamental. Nothing evil about it. It was an absolute necessity. But that's the argument. So I hope that's clear for everyone, thinking about that and what that means. So let me add one other thing in here, and I offer this with a great caution, because I don't want to, and I had said this to you once before in class, but I don't want you to think I'm trying to predetermine the Reformation or suggest that it had to happen when it happened. But there's one other element in world history that is critical for the rise of Northern Europe to become Protestant. And again, if we took a map, and I'm sorry I didn't bring one in today, but if we just took a post-Reformation map, you guys all know this, right? All of Southern Europe remained Catholic. Northern Europe became Protestant, with a few exceptions. Right? You've got a few pockets of Calvinism in places like Hungary. You've got a few pockets of Catholicism, like the Highlands of Scotland, and all the islands around Scotland all remain Catholic. You have a few communities in Scandinavia that remain Catholic. You've got places in the Baltics that remain Catholic. Right? I mean, there are places like that. But overall, you know, if we were to put, and it's always very interesting, if you were to put a map of the highest extent of the Roman Empire on top of a map of the post-Reformation world, it would look almost identical. All those places that had once been in the Roman Empire remained Catholic, and all of those that were out of the Roman Empire became Protestant. Now, why is that the case? Well, something major changes. And again, this is critical after what we just celebrated last week. You know, what is introduced in 1492, 1493 into Europe? The tomato and the potato. And that radically, fundamentally changes all of Europe. Because once the potato, an American food, whether it's a sweet potato or an actual white potato, or one variety of the white potato, once you introduce that into Ireland, into Scandinavia, you can now feed yourself 12 months out of the year. You couldn't do that before. So the Scandinavians and the Northern Germans always had a caloric disadvantage to the Southern Europeans because they had a short growing season. But with the potato, which grows anywhere, potatoes are the easiest crop. They're full of calories. They're healthy for you. You can store them for a very long time. Once you have the potato, the whole world changes. So I don't want to suggest, and I've had people write on the test before, Martin Luther could only have protested because he ate the potato. I'm not suggesting that. But I will suggest that for Prussia to become independent from the Catholics of Southern Europe, having an equal caloric intake is critical. So I won't say it demands the Reformation, but I would say that a sustained Reformation needs to be able to fend off what it once had to rely upon from Southern Europe. Does that... Okay, good. I hope I'm not being too biased about any of that. So I'm going to read to you, and this is my thought, but I'm taking this from one of my favorite scholars, Russell Kirk. By the way, I'll hand all this out. Everything I'm reading to you, I'll give to you. So I want you to think of this question. and it's a pretty big question. It's the one I asked last week. Is the Reformation a pro-Western movement or an anti-Western movement? That is, does it radically change Western civilization, or is it, as the name suggests, a reformation, a cleansing of Western civilization? So if we put Calvin and Socrates in the same room with, say, St. Augustine, would they get along? Would they be able to talk to one another? Or is Luther doing something so radically different that we can't find a counterpart to what he's doing in the Western tradition? So is the Reformation preserving Western civilization or destroying it? And I would ask you, try not to think about it in religious terms, but historical terms. I realize whatever your religion is, you're going to be slightly biased towards one thing or the other. That's understandable. But objectively, where do we put these guys? So I'll tell you of you I don't agree with, but you're welcome. I'm not, you guys can agree or disagree with me on this completely. It's a very open question. But one of my favorite scholars, not at the level of Russell Kirk, but another guy who just passed away, Jacques Barzun, and I think I have to double check. I think the guy lived till he was like 108 or something. I remember a news article when I was living in San Antonio that Barzun was 90 and just gotten remarried. He'd married some 35-year-old or something. Pretty funny. I mean, pretty amazing. But anyway, Barzun was one of these guys. He was writing, at the end of World War I. That's how long this guy lived. But Barzun, in one of his last books, wrote that he considered Luther the equivalent of Marx and Calvin the equivalent of Lenin. That basically Protestantism was the Marxism and fascism of its day. That's how violent they introduced. Now, I don't agree with that, but I want you to know that's at least Barzun, by the way, he was at Columbia and the University of Chicago. This is a major scholar. This is not some buffoon. He's a major scholar. I'm more on Kirk's side with this. Russell Kirk argues that the Reformation, especially the conservative Reformation, was a necessity to preserve what was happening, and that it was just as good for the Catholic Church as it was for the Protestants. It was good for everybody that Luther and Calvin did what they did. Here's what he writes. This is from 1974, from a book he wrote. The Protestant and Catholic Reformations. All right, keep that in mind. The Catholics have their own Reformation. Right? So that's going to be important, too. We haven't gotten to that yet, but it's generally called the Counter-Reformation. The Protestant and Catholic Reformations of the 16th century both were reactions against the excesses of the Renaissance. For that intellectual and artistic and social movement called the Renaissance amounted often to a denial of Christian understandings of the human condition. The Renaissance exalted man's ego in defiance of Christian teaching of humility, charity, and community. The Renaissance gloried in the fleshly pleasures of the world and accepted the power politics of Machiavelli as distinguished from the Christian political theories of justice, freedom, and order that had prevailed from the time of Gregory the Great to the time of Dante. So that's also a rather critical viewpoint, and yet a positive viewpoint, looking at Protestantism as a necessary corrective to the excesses of the Renaissance. So I leave it up to you, and I want you to think about it, though. Are what Luther and Calvin, are they more in line with Marx and Lenin, or are they more in line with Socrates? That is an open question. It's not a question any of us will solve. We're always going to have our bias when we enter into the question. But I do want you to think about it. What does that mean? And especially, for those of you who are Lutheran in particular, you've got to wrestle with this next year. This is a big deal that we're going to hit the 500th anniversary. That's a huge deal. That's a major moment in history on October 31st of 1517. Okay, so what are the questions then that arise? And I'll end with this today. We've just got a few minutes left. But let me throw these questions out to you. And this, I think, these are the critical questions of the Reformation. So, number one, the most important question is, what do we mean by sola gratia? Sola gratia means grace alone. And this had been the cry of the Catholic Church as well as the Orthodox Church, but especially the Catholic Church. This has been the cry of the Christian Church from basically the Council of Jerusalem, even before that, Pentecost, all the way up until the Reformation, and to this day. So you guys all know this. Any one of you who grew up Catholic, this is like the most prominent thing you were ever told, and it also can be the most annoying thing. Yeah, it's just grace. It's all grace. Let it go. It's all grace. Grace will take care of itself. Grace answers grace. Grace calls upon grace. This is, if you're Catholic, this is like the most obvious thing that you learn from day one. This is what you get. Notice what happens in the Reformation. Luther, too, believes in sola gratia. But his rallying cry is no longer just sola gratia. So for a Catholic or an Orthodox, there's no reason to talk about works versus faith, because it's all grace. If you do good works, it's because you were moved by grace. If you have faith, it's because you're moved by grace. If you walk around, it's because you're moved by grace. It's like everything is grace. Then Luther comes in and he says, it's actually three things. It's sola gratia, it's sola fide, and it's sola scriptura. So it is grace alone, it is faith alone, it is scripture alone. Now that's interesting. We start seeing a parsing of the old argument. Is it sola gratia, or does sola gratia have to become something more than that? So that becomes a major question. And as you guys are reading, and I'd ask you to read Luther, I would ask you to read Calvin now as well for Wednesday. As you're reading them, I want you to ask this question. All right, what's the difference? Sola gratia or sola gratia, sola fide, sola scriptura? Right, so is it grace alone, or is it grace alone and then something else? Second question becomes this. Major question. Where do we understand our truth? Do we understand it from revelation? Not revelation through church councils, through the Bible, through the teachings of the church, or do we understand it from Scripture alone? So the question becomes, the Protestants will say sola scriptura, we believe in Scripture alone. Catholics will say prima scriptura. We look first to the Bible, but when the Bible doesn't answer it, we look elsewhere. So sola scriptura versus prima scriptura. Where do we judge the Bible? Is it our sole source of authority, or is it our first source of authority? You guys are going to stop me if this doesn't make sense, right? I'm just going to keep going unless you stop me. Okay, so third question. Very important. Are there mediators in the economy of grace? So can I just approach God on my own? Or do I need to go through Mary or the saints or the sacraments? Priest, of course, I hope you guys all know this, priest comes from the Latin meaning bridge builder. It's bridge. A priest or a presbyter, same word, is one who builds a bridge between the divine and man. So do we just need a pastor or do we need a priest? It's a big question. So is the guy in front of us or the woman in front of us, are they somehow representing Christ physically, or are they just yet another one like us preaching the word? What's their role? Are they mediators or are they not? All right, last question then. And that is one I've already brought up, but what is the word? Is the word the Eucharist, or is the word scripture? For 1500 years, the word meant Eucharist, communion. Now suddenly, the word means Bible. Those are big changes. Okay, any final thoughts on those? Did I step on too many toes? Okay, good. Thanks, everybody. Make sure you've read Luther and Calvin. We'll keep going with this. And I'll try and remember to bring some maps in, but we'll keep going with this on Wednesday. So glad you're all back. Hope you all had a great Thanksgiving. Oh, your tests. Who didn't get tests back?
Yeah.
Sorry. Because there were a few of you, right?
Yeah, three of us.
When will we get our papers back?
Oh, I hope this week. Yeah, but I have to admit, I'm not, better words, they're not my priority right now, and
that's
I'm sorry about that.
It was Thanksgiving break.
No, I did get the test done, but no, I've got I should be better on the papers.
Okay. I don't know.
Veronica?
Thank you.
Okay, Sydney, yeah. Thanks. Sorry about that. And John. Wow, that looks like a mess.
See you, Dr. Bridget.
Bye, guys. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Bridget.
See you, Scott. Take care.
I'm working.